Orphan Black Season 4 Episode 1 is over, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. We are reconvening the Clone Club. I am Jessica Leese, and with me, as always, is honorary brother Sestra, Mr. Mike Bloom. Hello, Mike.
I am not Mike Bloom. My name is MB. I wear a mask of a pig, and I am Master Hacker.
Did I fool you?
All right. Yeah, you totally fooled me. I thought I had another clone in the mix there for a second.
Yeah, exactly. Because what other show would definitely bring in another variable in the equation four seasons in, except for Orphan Black?
Well, I feel like this is going to be the MO of Orphan Black for the rest of its run. You know, the MO is an MK every season.
Yeah, so, I mean, season one, we got our main four, which are Sarah, Cosima, Allison, and Helena. And then they brought in Rachel at the very end. Season two, we got Tony for that one rando episode. Yeah. Season three, we got Crystal for those couple of episodes. And I feel like you're right. We're on the path where they're sort of just introducing the, you know, under the guise of a clone project, they're able to bring in random clones from around the world. Though it seems like MK has kind of been involved in the action all along. She's just been more using a Beth conduit than really reaching out to Sarah until right now.
Yeah, well, you had to imagine there would be other clones mixed up in the whole Beth versus the Neolutionists thing. And it's not surprising that there'd be one out there who was kind of keeping, you know, who was being kept under wraps.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you think of her being like a master hacker? Is this like Miss Clone Bot, essentially, that she's sort of off the grid and now has this technological capabilities where she's going to be the puzzle piece to their organization of being able to hack into technology?
Well, I'm going to have to hear how Tatiana Maslany handles yelling enhance in that weird quasi Northern European / Slavic accent.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll definitely talk about After the Black, which is the new post show on BBC America for Orphan Black. But I guess it's inspired by Bjork, both from a dramaturgical perspective and a vocal perspective. Because when I was watching it, I'm like, I cannot place where that accent comes from, which, of course, chalked up to Bjork, who is just an enigma of a human being in general.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like an Icelandic accent to me. It's just kind of like... it's just kind of strange.
Yeah, and if it's Eastern European, it's the exact opposite of Helena's Eastern European, which is more, you know, Boris and Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and at this point, I don't think I know enough about MK to really have any kind of a draw on what she is and what she's like, because it seems to me like she just seems socially awkward with terrible hair, kind of like Helena. And she's got a weird accent, kind of like Helena. And I need to know what she's bringing to the table that we don't already have.
Yeah, she brings the fight online. That's what MK is. MK is like every internet commenter. I guess what Tatiana Maslany tried to differentiate is, I feel like Helena and MK both have these sensibilities that they're a little emotionally stunted. I mean, while Helena was sort of bred to be this killing machine by the Prolethians, MK seemed to, again, Tatiana Maslany believes that, like, she almost has the emotional maturity of, like, a 16-year-old, and that she's very non-communicative, a little socially awkward, as you just mentioned. So maybe there are sort of parallels, and maybe we'll see. We saw MK reach out to Sarah at the very end of this episode. Maybe Sarah will find some Helena parallels in MK that will lead to them coming together more, because it'll be interesting to track this relationship specifically.
Yeah, yeah, and this was something that they got into quite a bit. A really great supplemental listening, after, of course, you're finished listening to us, is to go into the EW podcast and listen to Dalton Ross interviewing the cast of Orphan Black, because they do kind of dig into the origins of MK and what she's like as a person. And I think Tatiana Maslany did spend quite a bit of time talking about the emotional stuntedness of MK, especially compared to the other clones. And the sense I get is the reason that MK is not part of the Clone Club at this point is because she didn't want to be, and she's kind of afraid to meet the other clones.
Yeah, I mean, she's holed up in a trailer somewhere. I mean, I think when we're talking about this Beth stuff, we also have to answer the question of, like, let's compare Beth and Sarah almost as central figures in Clone Club, because it seems like Beth was more so of the mind frame of like keep them separated. I mean, Cosima had to call Beth to tell her to tell Allison to wire the money over for her college tuition. Whereas I feel like nowadays they would just talk to each other face to face about it. And I feel like that holds true for MK as well, where I would beg to reason, I don't think Allison and Cosima might even know who MK is. I don't know if their contact with Beth and MK has been fairly recent, but I don't know. I felt like had they known who MK was, they would have brought it up to Sarah at some point over the past three seasons.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a passing comment somewhere in the episode where someone was aware that there's another clone out there. And it seemed to me like maybe there were a whole bunch of clones that Beth knew all about, and everyone else was just kind of complacent with the idea of, well, Beth knows who they are, so we don't need to.
Yeah, but it's essentially, yeah, it's like, you know, if you have a book club and one person is really gung-ho about the book club, so you're like, okay, you're going to organize all the meetings and where it's going to be. And so everyone else is like pretty much like, okay, I'm part of the club, but I don't actually need to contribute anything. And I mean, in the very beginning of the series, it seemed like Beth had her pulse on, you know, how many clones there were, and I think she was tracking like how many of them were getting killed off. So I would reason that she definitely has a database and she really is the center of this web, but maybe it's less of a web and more like a wheel with spokes, in that it seems like none of the spokes are really talking to each other.
Well, it actually kind of reminds me of like a terrorist cell where,
yeah,
where, you know who everybody in your cell is and you know one person above you, and that's all you need to know.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm a little scared as to why you know so much about terrorist cell organizations. That might be for after our podcast show.
Well, no, I can tell you very quickly. It's in a Robert Heinlein novel. He explains how terrorist cells are organized, or at least how they are for the purposes of this particular story. I think it's, I want to say it's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is the name of the book, and he talks about how those are structured. So that's where I got it. I read it in a book, just like everything I know about.
Is this going to be the first book that they read in Beth's proverbial book club?
Yes, I think that's definitely on the list. But, this isn't one of those lost scenarios where, there's just a random book that they throw in like, oh, look, it's Charles Dickens' last novel, or it's Incident at Owl Creek, and everybody rushes to read it. So...
Yeah, no Orphan Black bump for any of these literary works.
Well, Island of Dr. Moreau, I don't know how that did. But.
No, well, maybe people were buying a bunch of copies because they thought there was going to be some sort of, hidden genetic code buried inside of it.
Yeah, I would like, I would like to return this book. Someone wrote a bunch of random DNA gibberish in it.
And that's how Orphan Black ended.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So, well, what do you think of MK so far?
So... I mean, obviously, from what we've taken in so far, which as we've just spoken about, she is very emotionally stunted. She is super duper paranoid. She actually reminded me a lot of the sensibilities that our characters faced in the first season, where she believes that, there are spies sent by whoever these people may be out to look after the clones. And that turns out to be completely true, but it brought back to me the suspense from like the first three quarters of the first season, where they were thinking, is Paul a spy? Is Donnie a spy? Is Delphine a spy? All three were correct, but some of the fun of that first season was the paranoia that they face in terms of figuring out, are the people that are closest to you and the people you think love you the most actually sent by a science organization to get information on you?
Well, I guess that kind of brings the bigger question of, do you think it's a step backward for this show to go all the way back to the beginning and give us a prequel instead of, starting where we left off?
That's a great question. And I want to kind of flash ourselves back a little bit, not to 3 years ago, but to the end of the third season. And I would say now that we're on the other side of the third season, I do forget what we said at the end of the season, but I felt like seasons 2 and 3, to me, kind of strayed away from the path of what I enjoyed about Orphan Black, which was I really enjoyed the mystery aspects. And once we got to know more about the Dyad Initiative, and while we got to know more about the Prolethians, and they killed Leaky, and they were killing all these people off, they introduced all the caster clones, which I know a lot of people didn't like, and then summarily killed them off one by one. I feel like Orphan Black was getting away from that main center of suspense, mystery, and thriller aspects that we all really enjoyed that at least suckered me in from the beginning. So I was really happy that they took their time and spent the first episode really flashing back and showing things from Beth's perspective for a myriad of reasons. One is that we got to know who Beth was. We only saw through, you know, home video footage that Sarah uses in order to impersonate her to get to her bank account, and that one random dream sequence last season where, quote unquote, Beth talked to Sarah from beyond the grave. But other than that, we really didn't know who she was. So I thought this was a huge puzzle piece that got put into place in terms of figuring out what she is. We got to see, you know, how Maggie Chen got shot. We got to see how she got surveillance equipment placed in her house against Paul. So I love seeing that character, you know, is essentially having a new clone introduced, even though it was a character we already knew. And let's remember, we ended the third season with Dr. Nealon, before dying with that weird ass worm in his mouth, saying, "Hey, just so you know, the Neo-Illusionists have been behind all of this." And that was a little bit of a mind F, because I thought when Dr. Leakey got killed off and Dyad started to Dyad down, that Neo-Illusionism was basically gone. It was a cool buying in point to sort of tie these almost religious aspects into the show's mythology, but I thought we were moving on to something else. Tying it back, it might have seemed like a cop-out at first, but from the stuff we saw in the flashback, there seems to be a lot more to this Neo-Illusionist iceberg than we initially thought.
Yeah, you raise a good point, because I think one of the things we were complaining about last season was how every season it seems like, oh, here's a new bad guy, and this is the bad guy we're going to fight this season, and next season, you know, we'll have already defeated those bad guys, and we're going to need new bad guys. So it is kind of refreshing that we're not just getting, you know, brand new bad guy. We're going to have another bad guy who turns out, you know, it was the first bad guy, and he's much badder than we thought. And I think that's a kind of a fun idea to explore. And especially when you think, well, yeah, I thought Neo-Illusion wasn't a thing anymore. It's like, oh yeah, it's very much still a thing. And it could be very scary. Although I gotta admit, I didn't love going all the way back to the beginning, just because it felt like a lot of it was just sort of, it expected me to remember a lot of things from several years ago. And a lot of it was just very winky about like, I don't know if you are a watcher of Conan O'Brien.
Yes, occasionally.
Yeah. So he has a segment. He has a skit on his show that recurs every now and then. And for some reason, it slays me every time I see it.
Is it the Paul Rudd clip?
No, I love the Paul Rudd clip for sure. But this is a segment that Andy Richter kind of originated called Memba This. And it's basically Andy Richter stands in front of a screen, and behind him on the screen, he flashes these images of like random things from the past, like random 80s and 90s phenomena. And he'll point at it and he'll just say, "Remember this? Remember this?" And then Conan calls him out on how colossally stupid it is. And he's like, "Anybody can do that." So Conan tries to do it. And then like all the things on the screen are awful things.
Oh, God.
And every time I see it, like, it's the exact same skit every time with just like different things on the screen, and it always ends exactly the same way, but for some reason it completely slays me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this entire episode was just an extended version of Memba This, Memba Him, Memba
Maybe
That Guy.
Did Andy Richter turn out to be the new showrunner of Orphan Black?
It could be, you know, it was like, oh yeah, remember the guy with the tail, you know, remember Aldous Leakey, remember Maggie Chen, remember Ramon the drug dealer? You know, remember Angie? Like, yeah. I honestly didn't. So
it might be just because we're coming from different places, because podcasting for a show like Once Upon a Time here on Post Show Recaps, there is a lot of convoluted history that's built up over 100 plus episodes. And so I've had to reassociate myself, because I binged all those episodes at once, almost like I did with the first two seasons of Orphan Black. So I really had to reacquaint myself with that stuff. So maybe it's just because of a force of habit. I was fine going into the Orphan Black wiki and saying like, okay, who is Olivier? Who is Astrid? Have we seen this woman, Evie Cho, before? No, we haven't. Okay, let's keep an eye on her. I thought it was fine from that perspective. Though again, that might have been because I'd watched this season only last year. And so it was still relatively fresh in my mind. Like, and I knew, especially once they said, you know, previously on Orphan Black, here's what happened to Maggie Chen. You got to know that Maggie Chen's getting shot by the end. This is Chekhov's Chen, especially specifically.
Oh, for sure it is. Yeah. And I seriously don't mind that. Like, you know, I watch shows that do that in ridiculous, stupid ways all the time. Like Game of Thrones is notorious for just kind of taking a character that you saw one time in season one, and all of a sudden this person as a main character again. So, you know, it's something I don't expect from Orphan Black. Mm-hmm. And it felt a little bit like they were just seeing like how much stuff they could throw to see what stuck. And I agree, Maggie Chen was definitely the central focus of it. And you knew you were going to at least get a couple more pieces in that puzzle.
What did you think? Would it have been better for you if it wasn't nearly the full episode until the last minute being dedicated to Beth? Would you have seen, speaking of Lost, if it was more of like a flashback type of episode where we see stuff in the present day, but it keeps cutting back to Beth in the past?
You know, not necessarily, because I think it's just part of it is me being impatient because my nature is a binge watcher. Like that's who I am at the core. And when, you know, every show that I've fallen in love with, I've been able to fall in love with it because I've been able to watch like 24 hours of it over a weekend and then get caught up. Mm-hmm. And Orphan Black is kind of the same thing. Like I binged the entire first season before I got into the second season. And this one, you know, if I'm binge watching this season a year from now, I'm not going to have a problem with this episode at all. But it's just my impatient nature wanting to know, you know, we left off in such a strange place last season. I want to get back on that horse. So my chief complaint.
This is basically a better version of Across the Sea from Lost, where like major events happen the previous episode. You're wondering like, okay, what's going to happen now? And then they take an entire episode to show something completely different. I will agree, this is very slow paced compared to Orphan Black. There's still a lot that goes on that I'm sure we'll talk about. But Orphan Black, I just remember writing reams and reams of notes because so much was going on. And, you know, when you spread your clones out, you have four or five different storylines going on at once. It is a lot to track. But they really converged on one singular point, which has its benefits and its drawbacks. Its benefit is that it's very focused storytelling. I think, you know, we did have some problems last season about how, for example, Allison just seemed to be completely out of the picture and rarely interacted with the main storyline except for a couple of episodes. Whereas here, you can't really make that argument because Beth's story is the only story.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it also helps you feel a little more sympathy for Beth because you never really did know what the deal with that Maggie Chen thing was. Like, how cold-blooded was that? And it turns out the answer is not at all cold-blooded.
No, it was definitely an accidental thing, though. You know, adding to Beth's case here, or not her literal case against Maggie Chen, but her case is, you know, I think they alluded to her pill addiction beforehand, but we really see it here and how it's affecting her on the job. She's got a lot of drama with Paul because right now she's even suspecting, like Sarah did in season one, that he is, you know, he has been sent from an organization to spy on her. And things are complicated with Art as well. We knew that Art was in love with Beth, but we thought it was unrequited. Turns out it might have been a little requited before Beth throws herself in front of a train.
Yeah, well, there was definitely something there. I guess I like that a little bit better, that their relationship was messy and weird, and it wasn't just like Art putting her on a pedestal and pining for her secretly.
Yeah, which is basically what we saw Art doing the complete last season.
Yeah, yeah. And it's nice to get those little things filled in.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'd agree with that, definitely. So, you know, when she's in that final scene at MK's, I know it's not in the timeline, but I could definitely say, like, I could totally imagine the next scene is when she throws herself in front of the train, just because I do feel like the writers were really laying those breadcrumbs down that lead to that natural conclusion, where once she finds out about what Neolutionists are all about and she really buys into the theory that now they're after her and her sisters, she's really depressed. And the pills definitely aren't helping with that. And she, to top it all off, the cherry on top of the poo-poo sundae is that she just shot a civilian. And she's basically going to lose her job or at least be put on a heavy probation as a result. And the person that's sent to look after her, it might be a spy from the Neo-Lucianists. So I feel like there's just a lot of bad factors happening at once that really put her in a downward spiral.
Yeah, yeah, it's certainly, you certainly understand why she did what she did, whereas I don't think we ever really got it before. Like, we knew she had kind of, she was having a rough time at work, and she was in the middle of this terrible mystery, and people were after her, but nothing ever seemed like we were at the walk in front of a train point.
No, definitely not. And it was definitely a shocking image when that happened in the first 10 minutes of the first episode. So I can definitely understand that it might have been a little more slowly plotted compared to other episodes of this show. But at least now we can sort of fill in the story behind the blank canvas of that event.
Yeah, yeah. And if the Neo-Lucianists are going to be the bad guys this season again, then we need to have that backstory, and we need to understand that they were bigger than we thought.
Yeah. Speaking of which, do we want to talk about some of the stuff they were up to, or at least what these supposed paramedics were up to?
Yeah, we need to talk about the cheek choppers.
Oh, God, Jess, you know how much I hate gore on television. I was a little queasy just watching a man's cheek get cut off, but to have it actually happen later on in the episode, I was yelling at my television, no, 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 please stop it.
Yeah, and I gotta give big ups to the Foley artists on that one too. Because I the first time I watched, I didn't even really look at it because I couldn't deal, and the sound was bad enough.
Yeah, especially them like just pull, you know, they cut like three quarters of the edges of the rectangle, and they just sort of like pull the rest of it off. And then to have them dig around in it for the worm, which I'd forgotten about the worm, but the worm was definitely a question we had raised at the end of the last season, where what Neelan like went after Sarah and basically admitted to her like, hey, Neo-Lucianists have been behind this whole thing the entire time, and then tries to spit a worm into her mouth. We were a little bit like, wait, is he an alien? Is he, you know, from the Men in Black universe? What's going on? But this turns out to be a Neo-Lucian constant.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's funny because anybody that's ever seen Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
They call it Chekhov's worm in more ways than one.
Or Survivor Ko Rong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's an earworm. That's not a cheekworm. But
yeah, that's true.
But yeah, you don't want be generally moving things that go in your face. That's just not cool.
So do you have any, obviously this is the first episode this season, but do you have any thoughts about what this worm might mean? Because from what it seems like, the Neo-Lucianists were just taking people of their own, putting this little grain in their cheek as sort of an implant, I guess. And then once they found it got out of control and I guess became sentient and became a worm, then they decided to kill them because of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, that seems like what's going on. It's like, you know, you're hanging out at this cool party with all these cool gothy people with different colored eyes. And you're thinking, this is pretty awesome. I'd kind of like to get some implants. So you sign up for some implants. And then while you're under getting the implants, they give you extra implants.
Yeah, that old switcheroo that they do at the plastic surgeon's office.
I mean, you gotta wonder, like, man, this bill is kind of cheap. Like, they just bifurcated my genitalia and they charged me $29.95. Like, there's got to be a catch here somewhere.
Thank God. If this show is on HBO, you knew they were showing that bifurcated penis.
Yeah, you know, there was a Reddit AMA about a guy that had that naturally.
Yeah, so, I mean, is there a difference, though, between, like, having two separate penises and a bifurcated penis? I thought the bifurcated penis is basically that version of, like, if you ever got a hot dog that was, like, split open at the end and splayed out, it's essentially that.
I want the record to show that you brought that up.
Listen, it's a part of my body. I think about it and its safety, specifically when it's brought up in the realm of a show like Orphan Black, when I'm forced to think about the thought of it being bifurcated.
Yeah, yeah, I think they... vision that you're throwing down there, I think it's probably more accurate. And you know, I tried not to picture it too hard, and I'm very grateful that, you know, we're on BBC America.
Yeah, exactly. What did you think about the fact that these two, and I guess they're technically henchmen, though very horny henchmen at that. I don't know. I personally would not get a rise out of dropping a body into a hole that would make me want to make out with my respective partner if she was there. But, yeah. You know, I'm not going to judge. But the fact that they're under the guise of like paramedics and that they're, I don't know, are they like going to Clum the Illusion and saying, okay, get in the ambulance so that in case anyone sees them, they'll just think that they're being tended to by EMS?
But, you know, I'm not a club kid. But I got to think that even a club where lots of people who have dubious surgical modifications hang out, if there's an EMS van hanging out, if you got the bus outside every single night and they're bringing different people into it every night, I'm not going to want to hang out at that club because I'm going to think, you know, something's going on here. This is not safe. I could be the next person to like inhale the wrong balloon of nitrous or something.
Yeah, and it brings up a good question, and actually I think that's the impetus behind this one girl with the septum piercing, Trina, who, when Beth first goes to Clum the Illusion after MK's tip, she talks to her about, you know, she's scared about what might have happened to Edward Capra, aka Bass Pair 86. And I think that legitimate fear got to her because she calls Beth and talks about how her boyfriend Aaron is gone now. And so you have to wonder, like, do you think there's a running paranoia amongst this crowd, or are they so drugged up and drawn in under Leakey's guidance that they don't even mind that people are disappearing around them?
Yeah, or maybe you're thinking like, well, you know, maybe you know what the risks are. Maybe you understand them and you're thinking, well, it's a small price to pay to have magnetic fingertips.
Yeah, I mean, that is pretty cool. I think we've seen that before on the show, right? The magnetic fingertips as a modification.
Yeah, we have, but how do you handle digital media if you've got magnetic fingertips? Like, can you even use a laptop?
I was going to say, your phone, you're probably going to, you know, have to get 30 new phones. You're never going to be able to handle a credit card because that's going to get demagnetized as soon as you touch it.
Yeah, like, what if you work someplace where you have an ID badge?
Yeah, I mean, this might be a case of like, you know, someone from Heroes where they just sort of have to live in the shadows and just, you know, work only with, maybe they're like wood carvers where they can only work with wooden non-metal products.
Yeah, or maybe they're like Chuck on Better Call Saul. They can't leave the house without a space blanket.
Yeah, they're grounded in more ways than one.
Yeah. So, yeah, I it seems to me like you have to be pretty far under this guy's spell not to be a little concerned for your own safety.
Speaking of which, were you excited to see the return of Dr. Leakey? Because I remember, I believe, in our very first Orphan Black podcast we did together when we talked about seasons 1 and 2, that I think we were both a little shocked / a little disappointed that Leakey was built up as the big bad and then Donnie accidentally kills him in the middle of season 2.
Yeah, he basically gets the Marvin from Pulp Fiction death.
Yes, so did Donnie bring him to Harvey Keitel to clean up his suit and take care of him?
I assume that Allison knows like 5 Harvey Keitels.
Yeah, absolutely. Specifically now that she's gotten involved with the drug trade.
Yeah. Although, seems to me that we've learned that Allison's involvement in the drug trade goes pretty far back.
Yeah, I mean, she did talk about that, you know, I think her storyline last season was just to eliminate her middleman. So it seemed like she was, I don't know how often she was making these courier deliveries to Beth, but we knew even from that point she could very easily get her hands on narcotics.
Yeah. But apparently she wasn't the gun savvy person that we thought she was originally.
Yeah, that's true. And again, this makes you wonder, how long ago does this happen in the timeline? Because it's obviously before Beth threw herself in front of the train, but shortly after, when Sarah's identity is kind of revealed, Allison is very, very adept at handling a gun. So you have to assume that some period of time has passed, or a situation where Allison has to immediately learn how to handle a gun.
Or maybe Allison's just one of those people who's extremely driven. Like, she's used to excelling at everything she does.
Maybe she's like that, the main character from Wanted, and learned how to, like, she's like some sort of savant and learned how to curve a bullet.
Maybe so. Like, we haven't seen her do it on the show yet, but that doesn't mean she doesn't know how.
Exactly. But I guess going back to my initial question, you know, we see Leakey briefly here, but I feel like with Neolutionism coming back, his presence is sort of shown over the next several episodes. I mean, we're of the season 1 characters that came back, were there ones that you were excited about or not so excited about?
You know, I was really, like, I was excited to get to know Beth, and I'm excited to get to know a new clone, but honestly, like, all of these season 1 people, it's like, eh, you know, these people are mostly dead at this point, and it felt to me like a step backward to spend so much time on them. Like, you know, Tail Guy, he was gross and he remains gross. So really, honestly, I didn't think we needed as many of them as we did. Like, was there anybody that you've been missing?
I mean, I was happy to see Leaky just because, again, there's a big question mark in terms of Neolutionist hierarchy, and with him dead, but still it apparently functioning, like, who is the person that's in charge of that? Could it be Sarah, Rachel's mother, essentially, who we thought was dead, but wasn't. So it's one of those things of, like, the Dharma Initiative, like, once you see the man in charge and the man in charge dies, like, you know, when we saw Tom Friendly on the boat at the end of season one and we're like, oh, he must be in charge. But no, it turns out that Ben Linus is in charge the entire time. Like, that's the type of stuff that I'm interested in. I mean, I was also pretty happy to see Paul. I do feel like, I think we said that, you know, his death episode last season was probably the best episode of the season, and they really sent off the character well. I think it's very clear that the creators love him, so they decided to bring him back in some sort of capacity. So it was nice to see, again, that tie into Beth's paranoia. But yeah, outside of that, I mean, the other, like, dyad randos, or the Neolutionist randos, it was fine. Art, obviously, he's still on the show, but it was nice to get some more character background fleshed out there. Angie, I was not happy to see, just because I was never a fan of her character and how she was sort of set up as an antagonist, specifically in season two, and that sort of ended up fizzling out once the whole Prolethean thing stopped. So, yeah, I guess it's more of a mixed bag for me. But again, seeing Leaky there reminded me of how much of an open market Neolutionism is and how we're hopefully going to be able to explore that market this season.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how far down the rabbit hole we can go. And also, I do love that idea that the guy we thought was the really big bad guy is really not the bad guy at all. Like, he's really mostly a figurehead. So it will be interesting to see who the real guys are, because there will probably be four of them, but I probably won't be able to tell them apart until three quarters of the way through the season.
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, you know that they're going to get in contact with them in some way, shape, or form. I mean, MK basically tipped off Sarah that the Neolutionists now know where they are. And then this begs the other question of, how much time has passed, do you think, between season three and that wake-up scene at the end of season four? How long has, you know, Sarah been living in Iceland before the Neolutionists are onto them? Was it an immediate thing, or do you think some time had passed where they gathered some information and then decided to go after them?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. She seemed pretty comfortable, but who knows?
Yeah. What did you think about, going back to the Neolutionists, we have this woman, as I talked about before, Evie Cho, who seemed to be a confidant of Leaky's, or at least important enough in the organization to, like, have some very pertinent shots and lines. And again, I don't believe we've seen her thus far in the show. And again, listeners, feel free to correct me on that. But it seems like she's one of those people, like you were saying, that is just randomly going to pop up in season four and turn out to be, you know, the hand that held the crown.
Yeah. We're basically meeting her now so that we can meet her again in subsequent episodes and be like, oh, yeah, it's that person. And she apparently, I'm going to guess she picks up the mantle that Dr. Leaky leaves behind. And I'm going to guess she's pretty deeply involved in whatever thing they're going to have to fight.
Yeah, I could definitely imagine that. I think she's involved in some sort of capacity. Again, I wouldn't be surprised, as you mentioned, if she's presented as the person in charge for the first, like, four episodes, and then she gets killed off or something, and it's revealed that, no, this person is the one that's in charge.
Yeah. Like, you know, we got Neelan, we got Fernando, we got the creepy, huge guy that kills people, and, you know, you're expected to know who they all are.
Yeah, exactly. We need a Facebook for Orphan Black characters sometimes.
We really do. Like, it's nice that in this digital age, everything has a wiki.
Very, very true, including Orphan Black. So definitely check it out. It definitely helped alleviate my confusion. Should we talk about Maggie Chen for a couple seconds? Because as you said, this really was Beth's inciting incident that kind of started her down this depressive, icy slope.
Yeah. It was interesting to me that it didn't actually matter all that much in the end who Maggie Chen was.
Exactly.
Just that she's somebody who's following Beth.
Yeah, because I think in previous episodes, they linked her to being with the Neolutionists, though it seemed she was working on both sides between like the Prolethians and the Neolutionists. She was one of the people along with Tomas who raised Helena. So she was clearly playing both sides. And as Aubrey from Survivor Ko Rong may say, if you're walking between two sides of the road, you might get run over. And this is sort of what happened, in that she just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think she was trying to escape the Neolutionists then, and then she basically accidentally got gunned down by Beth, who thought that the person coming after her was this rando cop that was in the precinct earlier in the day, who turns out to be working with the Neolutionists as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And curiously enough, like having seen it happen, it does, like I said, make Beth a little more sympathetic, because you thought originally that Maggie Chen was somebody that Beth had had some interaction with, and that, you know, knowing all the stuff that she was involved in, you would imagine that Beth was researching her and had like a dossier and was, you know, trying to, you know, get to the bottom of what her involvement was. And you kind of thought maybe she'd concluded that this Maggie Chen person was really bad and needed to be stopped. And so she gunned her down in cold blood. And it turns out that's not at all what happened.
And on top of that, we got to see an interesting side of Art as well, because I feel like at least for the first couple seasons, Art stood for like the letter of the law. And he almost, you know, he was very suspicious of Sarah to begin with. And so you thought of him as more of like straight laced by the books. But when it's someone that he really cares about, we see him, you know, once he gets that call from Beth saying, like, I screwed up really bad. He is the one that puts the phone in her hand. He is the one that points at Beth and says, okay, this is your story. He is the one that organizes this entire alibi. So he kind of, you know, goes behind the backs of his employers to help protect the person he loves.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you got a hint of that when you found out that he was in love with Beth. And you assumed that his involvement in this whole thing was probably a little bit less, you know, straight-laced, like, get your act together, just because he's, like, on the side of everything lawful good. But, yeah, this definitely gives you a little bit more depth to what their dynamic was like and how totally messy their partnership was.
Is it just me, or did this guy, Dr. Tuco, look like an extra from the movie Argo? Like, between like the comb over and the beard, he looked like he was coming out of like 1977.
Oh yeah, he totally looked like he was a serial killer in the 70s.
Yeah, and maybe he was reading that book that you were alluding to as well.
Maybe he was. Yeah, he actually, like, he seemed like the kind of guy, like, I also have been binging Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt this weekend, and mm-hmm. With the beard, he gave off a very Reverend Richard Wayne, Gary Wayne vibe.
Absolutely. All you needed is a guitar and the Flying Purple People Eater song.
And a short sleeve dress shirt.
And karate moves.
Yes. So he's totally got a van. Like, you know what vehicle that guy drives. He drives a
Absolutely.
Van.
Absolutely. I mean, the question is, do we think we're going to see more of him pop up? Is he like Evie Cho, one of these other characters that we'll see come to prominence? Because when Sarah, after Beth died and Sarah took her place, I don't believe we ever saw him again.
No, we've never seen this guy until this episode. I am going to imagine that he's going to be kind of a menacing, shadowy figure for a few episodes. And he is definitely going to die.
Yeah.
He's toast.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if we happen to get another Beth flashback, that she ends up killing him, and that might be the straw that breaks the camel's back and makes her kill herself, because she realizes that she's just getting too much blood on her hands at this point.
Yeah, that could be. I think my hunch is that we're going to see that guy again. Like, I don't think he's dead yet.
Yeah, definitely not. Again, I think we talked about this with Orphan Black, that like usually if a character comes on and has a name, they're going to have some pertinence for the plot.
Yep. Like, anytime a name is mentioned, just write it down, because you might need it later.
Or like 3 seasons from now, apparently.
Yeah. Evidently, I should have been paying much closer attention when I watched the first season. Yeah. But I think maybe this is all the Beth flashback we get. Like, we get one episode about Beth, and then we're going to go back to the current day.
I can imagine that, especially since it seems like they're hitting the ground running with this last scene of this episode, which, by the way, I love the cinematography on this. The whole episode has just been a series of Beth being woken up while sleeping by a cell phone ringing, and to have it be Sarah for the last one, I think was just an awesome choice from a writing and you know, camera work perspective. But it seems like now we're bringing back all the characters, we're bringing back all their subplots, we're bringing back all the mystery. I don't think we're going to have that much time to really languish in Beth's land again.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fine to do that once, and it's fine to do it. I think if you're going to do it anywhere, you got to do it at the beginning of the season, because I think if this were episode 3 or 4 and we were, you know, stuck on a cliffhanger right before it, we'd be even more upset, which, you know, Walking Dead did this in the first half of season 6. There was a character and they showed what looked like a very gruesome death, but you didn't know whether he was dead or alive. And then the following episode was a 90-minute flashback about a character who had, it went back to a time where he had no interaction with anybody else from the show.
And it
was the most aggravating thing. And the whole thing was about him learning martial arts with a goat.
So are you sure this wasn't Reverend Wayne, John Gary Wayne?
You know, I'm not entirely unsure.
Yeah, that's just trolling at that point. Yeah. I don't think Orphan Black was trolling us here. I think they were just introducing the season in a new and different way, and hopefully this means that, hey, we're going to go back to our roots, which I believe the creators were talking about in interviews before this season, that they knew they kind of got a little out of control in the past 2 years, and they really wanted to bring it back to the matters at hand, which I think bringing it back to the Neolutionists is one big example of that.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. I think there's a lot of room for exploration when it comes to the Neolutionists, especially if they're pulling the strings on everybody. I think that's kind of cool, and I'm going to be very happy. I'm going to be very happy if we get to get a little more backstory into that, and if we don't have to be introduced to an entirely new, like, layer of complexity.
Yeah. Absolutely. You spoke of Walking Dead before. I feel like we have to talk about After the Black here.
Really?
I mean, so you are, as you talked about, a watcher of Walking Dead. And I feel like ever since The Talking Dead took off, there has been this kind of model of post-show live immediate feedback. I mean, it's transgressed to the reality forum with the post Bachelor and Bachelorette stuff. They're doing it with Game of Thrones this season, and here we have it as well. It's only a half an hour as opposed to the other stuff, which I think is an hour. It looks like it's Morgan Hoffman and AJ Frey, who are hosts of Inner Space. I'm not entirely sure what that is. I don't watch too much, you know, BBC America to know if that's actually a thing, but it seems like they're bringing on people from the show. This week it's Tatiana Maslany and Kevin Hanchard, and they just sort of talked about their characters, the episode, and they showed a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So I would love to know from your perspective, Jess, how does this compare to other shows like The Talking Dead?
Well, honestly, this was very clearly a transparent attempt to cash in on the success of Talking Dead by ripping off their formula, and it really fell flat to me. Like, the hosts, like, while they were enthusiastic, they were very, very chipper. And the guy kept yelling. It was like he was in a Big Brother confessional. It's like, you have a microphone, you don't have to do that. And it really, they were a little bit too hyperactive for my tastes. And I don't think we learned a lot. Like, honestly, in the recent weeks, I was able to attend a panel discussion at the 92nd Street Y featuring the cast and producers of Orphan Black, which was fantastic and which I can't talk about yet because they told us some kind of spoilery things. And then I also listened to the aforementioned Dalton Ross interview, and I think both of those things were far more insightful than this kind of little, you know, dare I call it a post-show recap. and I think it didn't feel very well thought out to me. Like, you got little teasers of behind the scenes, but you just got these hosts kind of injecting a little too much of their personality into it.
So I'm intrigued with The Talking Dead specifically. Is it more of an interview thing? I don't know. It goes beyond like the creator and actor interviews, and they bring in like random celebrities because Walking Dead is that much of a popular show. But do they also do like random behind the scenes stuff, or is it very interview centric instead?
No, they do some random behind the scenes stuff. Like, basically, granted, Talking Dead has an hour to fill. It's not a quick half an hour thing. So they have an interview segment, and then they'll have a segment where they take questions from the audience, and then they have like a little behind the scenes vignette, and they have some trivia, and it's a lot of different things, but it's very much, it seems a lot more insightful to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to badmouth this too much, but I'll admit something, Jess. Unfortunately, Tatiana Maslany, in my opinion, did not give a good interview. I mean, she was like, I don't know when this was filmed, but she was like stumbling over her words. It seemed like she had trouble getting thoughts together sometimes. I mean, I think the one piece of information besides the Bjork thing that I really got out of this was the fact that, and nobody brought this up except for AJ Frey, the host, who said that MK might be named after MK Ultra, which was a project from the CIA to basically like harshly experiment on people to determine if they could harness mind control powers, which is a super interesting idea. I do love Tatiana trying to play it up like she knew that, but still, I don't know when this came in terms of the course of their, their press junket that they did in preparation for this season, but it seemed like it was done at like 11 o'clock in a random studio lot when they were all just really tired and running on empty.
Yeah, it did. And they didn't like, this is a show that clearly has so much you can talk about, like so many different references and like places to take it. And they really skimmed the surface.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the chances are that they'll keep having Tatiana Maslany on every week, considering how she plays like the lion's share of characters on the show?
Well, the question I had was, are they even going to do it every week? Because like Better Call Saul, for example, had one at the beginning and one at the end, kind of similar to how we're going to be covering this, this particular series. And I wonder if they're really going to have enough to, especially the way they're interviewing these people and the amount of information they're giving up, is this something that's going to be worthwhile for them to air every single week?
Yeah, I mean, they do have like a good main cast, and actually this would be a good time to mention that no Donnie, no Siobhan, surprising cameo from Felix, which I thought was fun. It was just a cute little scene where Felix is arrested in the precinct, and there's a nice little bit about how, he was arrested for like narcotics possession, solicitation, and public urination, which Felix, almost like in a Titus Andromedon way, chalks up to a performance piece. And it's interesting that like he doesn't notice that Beth might look like his half-sister. But yeah, so I feel like they do have, the behind the scenes stuff showed the cast interacting as well. And from that Dalton Ross EW interview, they're clearly a cast that has fun. So I could imagine them bringing them in for future weeks. But yeah, I don't know if they could pad it out for basically, 300 minutes of time.
Yeah, it does seem like a pretty big burden if you're not willing to dig really deep into the kind of rabbit hole conspiracy theory things that make this show so interesting, which they don't seem to be. Although I will say that if they're going to get Christian Bruin, who plays Donnie, to come back, and if he comes and sits on one of those panels, I can say that that's going to be a fun one and one you shouldn't miss. Because when I saw the cast, I was speaking to 92nd Street Y recently, he basically stole the entire thing out from under everybody.
Interesting. Like, how so?
Everything that comes out of his mouth is hilarious.
Okay. So he's basically, there's a reason why Donnie, is the most hilarious character on the show. Felix might be a close second, but
yeah.
Clear that like the writers are like, okay, let's give a laugh line to Christian.
Yeah. And he's just naturally that funny, and he was not afraid to dish. So that is something to look forward to.
Are there any things you can say about the 92nd Street Y talk back that is not spoilery that you'd like to impart upon our audience?
Well, it was one of the things that I noticed, and this is really not about the talk itself, but about the people attending the talk. I liked to think of myself as a fan of Orphan Black, and I went to this talk and I observed the audience, and it turns out that I'm not a fan of Orphan Black. I'm just someone that watches the show a lot and does a podcast about it.
You're a casual.
Yeah, I'm a casual. I'm such a casual.
Well, you're not going onto the Orphan Black Facebook page and posting things, right?
No, certainly not.
Yeah.
Not that kind of casual.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know you had talked to me about how like people did cosplay, which is so interesting to me for a, not even a convention, just a specific talk back.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody showed up in full Ukrainian celebration gear.
Oh, man. Are you sure they just weren't coming from the United Nations?
I'm pretty sure. And there were several Helena wigs. So, yeah, people were really, really into it, which was fun. It was contagious, and it definitely got me very excited.
Well, this sort of brings up a question that I'd like to ask you, because in the time that we've recorded this, Tatiana Maslany, you know, heavens opened up and she got an Emmy nomination for Best Leading Actress in a Drama at the Emmys this year. And I haven't checked the ratings yet, but do you think Orphan Black has been brought into the mainstream a little bit more as a result? Or do you still think it's sort of this like cult TV show that everyone is freaking out about and it's a small but fervent audience?
Well, I think an interesting thing that happened recently that we discovered in the post-show recaps universe is our resident amateur statistician, Sean Falconer, did a study on which shows in the world have the most podcasts about them. And, you know, there were some ones at the top that shouldn't surprise people. Like you had your Game of Thrones, you had your Walking Dead, but Orphan Black was curiously in the top five. And there are like 49 podcasts devoted to talking about Orphan Black.
Yeah.
And I think that definitely points to a very deep love for the show, but I don't know how broad that love is yet. And I think the fact that there are that many people willing to talk about it at that level, like it's certainly got a cult status that can't be denied, but I do think we're pulling people in. It seems to be gradually gaining steam, and it's certainly not losing its audience.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's really been, if anyone was deterred from the third season at all, they'd be out by this point. But I feel like that's a great metric that you brought up from Sean's research about the fact that, you know, this audience is small, but they like to talk about it. And I feel like when you get word of mouth that, you know, this isn't some like smaller show you find on USA that a good handful of people are watching, but nobody's really talking about. This show is interesting enough that people are making podcasts, as an example here, about our theories and our thoughts about the show. And so I feel like that creates enough of a fervor that it keeps the show going. But I wonder how many people, you know, are added on. Another interesting thing that they did in terms of broadcasting, at least in America, is that this used to air Saturday nights. Now it airs Thursday nights, which is definitely more of like a prime time slot as opposed to Saturday night, which was more of a DVR show. You know, oh, I'm out for the night. Let me tape Orphan Black and watch it Sunday morning.
Yeah. And it also, I think it also gives you more opportunity if you are a person that DVRs everything, it gives you the whole weekend to catch up on it.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if DVR numbers increase.
Yeah, very true. Again, I haven't looked up the ratings and I don't know, you know, they might not even come into effect until after the weekend and the DVR numbers are accounted for, as you just mentioned. But I do wonder, maybe it's something we can look at over the season, which, as you talked about, is a good time to point out that we will be returning at some point. Definitely we'll do at least one podcast at the end of the season. But for right now, if you want to compare it to other coverage on post-show recaps, if you listen to what we did with Parks and Recreation in the final season, it'll be something like that, where we'll definitely do this episode, we'll do the last episode, we might do something in between in case like a major thing happens. But pretty much, we're going to go into radio silence for a little bit and just sit back and enjoy the season.
Yeah, yeah, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So feel free to get at us with your theories and your questions, and there's lots of ways that you could do that. We are easy to find.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find Jess at Haymaker Hattie on Twitter. I am at A Mike Bloom Type. If you want to reach out to us personally with your thoughts and questions throughout the season, you could always respond to this page on postshowrecaps.com as well. Just, you know, write your comments throughout. And I'm sure Jess and I will be tracking it through the season. So, you know, I wish we could give more of a concrete date for our next podcast, but, you know, stay tuned for your feed because you never know when. Just like Maggie Chen being surprised at being shot randomly in an alley, a podcast may drop into your feed that contains Orphan Black coverage.
Yeah, yeah. And I would really, if it was me, I'd be frantically checking the feeds every single week. Because who knows, like it might be the week that the amazing thing happens and we're going to need to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, one of the reasons why there are so many podcasts about the show is because it has a great community of fans. So no matter what, podcasts or not, let's keep this conversation going, because it sounds like it's going to be a super interesting season.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun ride. I'm really looking forward to, like, the two pieces of information that I'm most looking forward to. Like, we are going to get to know this new clone, MK, but we're also apparently going to be seeing a lot of Crystal.
So. Interesting. That makes me happy, because I think we were both really into her when she was introduced. She was sort of like a valley girl, but she had sort of like a softness to her, you know, when Felix and Sarah try to con her and they actually feel kind of bad for doing it. This woman's also so unlucky in that she gets switched out for Rachel so that Rachel can escape with the mechanical eye. Like, this poor woman, I would love to see where she goes after she's, you know, bottomed out in her life right now.
Yeah, it seems like she's going to be joining the Clone Club.
That's fantastic.
And the teaser that I got was that she and Donnie have a scene together that's pretty epic.
Oh man, Crystal and Donnie. I'm shipping that. Crony,
yeah,
Distal, yeah. One of those two.
I'm definitely also shipping Crony. So, all right, Mike. Do we have anything else we need to cover?
No, I mean, this was great getting to talk with you again about this show. You know, even though it was one episode, there was a lot in there. And again, I'm looking forward to getting together with you in the indeterminate future to talk about the show at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess until that point, I want to thank you all for tuning in. Please leave us your comments and feedback. Do we have a hashtag that we want to throw out there for people?
I have a few options, but the one I'm settled on is Richter Black, in honor of the fact that Andy Richter might be running this show based on the member this mentality of this episode.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So tweet at us with Richter Black if you made it all the way to the end. So thanks again, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll see you whenever we do.